Sunstone presents the Sermon on the Mount, what its textual transformation discloses concerning the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake, Sheraton, and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
The Sermon on the Mount, what its textual transformation discloses concerning the historicity of the Book of Mormon. The first published Greek New Testament was the 1516 edition by the Dutch scholar Erasmus. For the Sermon on the Mount, the printer set type directly from a 12th century manuscript with corrections made from a 15th century manuscript, as well as a few corrections from the little used but extremely valuable 12th century manuscript number 1. This popular printed text by Erasmus crystallized for us the particular form of Greek text found in the manuscripts that Erasmus used. The sumptuously printed third edition in 1550 by Robert Stephanus had the text of Erasmus along with the first critical apparatus of selected variant readings in the inner margin. The 1611 King James Version was primarily based on Beza's 1598 edition of the Greek New Testament. The printers, Elsevier, published Greek New Testament editions in 1624 and 1633, and it is this last edition which first employed the term textus receptus, meaning the received text. Since the text in these various editions, these Greek editions of the New Testament, is substantially the same, and since for the Sermon on the Mount there are no differences between the 1550 edition of Stephanus and the 1633 edition, one can use the term textus receptus to refer to either one of them. This term may lead some to believe that it rests on unquestionable authority, but the textus receptus is only entitled to our respect insofar as it can be shown to exhibit a text in conformity with the best manuscripts. The few late manuscripts that historically were the basis of the printed textus receptus contrast sharply with our present availability of hundreds of cursive manuscripts going back to as early as the 9th century. For the Sermon on the Mount, there are thousands of manuscripts altogether, but we have hundreds for the Sermon on the Mount going back to the 9th century. There are 32 unsealed or capital letter manuscripts from the 4th to the 10th century, and one papyrus dated AD 200. How does our modern understanding of the Sermon on the Mount differ from the text accepted in the 16th century? This is a picture of the papyrus that was found, known as P64, that has the text of part of the Sermon on the Mount. If one were to follow just one printed edition, or a single manuscript as best, there would be the danger of relying on the possible prejudices of that particular editor or the scribal idiosyncrasies of that one manuscript. To avoid discussing points about which there may be a wide difference of opinion, and to avoid the pitfall of dependence on any one source or playing one set of scholars against another, the following late 19th and 20th century editions of the Greek New Testament have been examined for their text of the Sermon on the Mount. The editors of, or committees behind, these 11 editions reached their decisions by following different lines of evidence based on their own assessment of what was the most significant factor in each case. They represent a whole range of critical positions. There is Tischendorf's preference for his discovery, Codex Sinaiticus, and Westcott and Hort's preference for the oldest unsealed, Codex Vaticanus, to counterbalance von Soden's mechanical preference for the type of text whenever it happened to be supported by one of his two main dissensions. There is a range from the committee decisions behind the Nestle Arnold 26th edition and Tasker's Greek edition of the New English Bible on the one hand, to the individual Roman Catholic scholarship of Merrick and Beauvais on the other. Finally, there is the stylistic eclecticism of Kilpatrick and the focus on synoptic interrelationships and harmonizations between the Gospels of Grievan. A collation of each of these texts, as they printed for the Sermon on the Mount, against the textus receptus, generates 11 sets of variants. With this wide spectrum of scholarly judgment, it is a marvel that there are any significant variant readings in the Sermon on the Mount where all 11 of these authorities agree against the textus receptus. Also, these editions must print the reading without brackets in the main body of the text and not relegate it to the margin, footnote, or the critical apparatus. A majority agreement among such diverse scholarly positions on any one variant reading would be a powerful agreement. Even stronger agreement is reached if one follows the strict rule that agreement among these authorities must be unanimous. Further restrictions on the choice of examples are that there must be support from each of the three earliest versions, the Latin, the Syriac, and the Coptic, as well as from patristic writers of the 2nd and 3rd centuries. 11 passages have been selected in which these 11 editions agree concerning the original text of the Sermon on the Mount against the Textus Receptus. These passages provide the basis for the following minimal statement that does not delve into debatable or controversial readings. These examples will be examined in some detail with an indication of the external evidence supporting that particular variant. Whenever the margin of the 1550 edition of Stephanus has a variant reading, this information is cited because it enables us to see what was known in the mid-16th century. And, of course, it is important to see the array of evidence on both sides of the question in order to reach any kind of balanced judgment about a particular reading. The examples that we'll look at have been grouped into three categories. Passages that show, one, an influence from the immediate context, where a passage, something is said in the immediate environment of the text, and that has affected the reading in the nearby verse or other part of a verse. Number two, an influence from the Lucan parallel. We're talking about Matthew, but very often in the early centuries, statements that were in Luke on a parallel passage were brought into other texts. And the third category is a simple textual addition. The modern critical texts found in examples 1, 6, and 10 are to be preferred because they can in various ways be shown to be the original text, not because they happen to be supported by the majority of Greek manuscripts. For it must be remembered that a secondary text can become dominant due to ecclesiastical authorization and thus be copied many more times than other texts. Counting manuscripts is thus not as significant as weighing their value. The readings of the modern critical texts in the other examples are supported by considerably fewer number of manuscripts, but these manuscripts are demonstrably older and of better quality. Varying combinations of diversified and early external support and both transcriptional and intrinsic internal considerations have led to the preference of these readings over the Textus Receptus. Now, in the interest of time, only three of the 11 examples that I have selected will be discussed here. One from each of those three main categories, and the full discussion is found in the published form of this paper. Number three, then. The first one is category one. The earliest text lacks a contamination from the immediate context. The passage is Matthew 5:30. This is showing how some of the Gospels relate to each other. It was listed originally as example number two. At Matthew 5:30, the reading, following the order of words in the original, it's a bit awkward in English, but it comes out, "Into hell go all," is supported by Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Family 1, the margin of 1550, Textus Receptus. A sub-variant of this reading, that is, within the same kind of support, but slightly different, has the order supported by D, several minuscules, and it reads, "Go off into hell," in that order. Most of the old Latin manuscripts, the Vulgate, the Sinaitic Syriac, the Keratonian Syriac, the Palestinian Syriac, the Bahiric, and the Middle Egyptian, match the text and order of "go off into hell." But due to the looseness of word order in translation, or perhaps a grammatical preference for the position of a prepositional phrase, these versions, not the Greek manuscripts, but these versions, may just as likely be derived from a Greek text that said, "into hell, go off." Now the other form, the variant reading, is "be cast into hell," is a scribal assimilation to the same reading at the end of the immediately preceding verse. It is supported by 16 uncials, Family 13, and the majority of Greek manuscripts. A few old Latin manuscripts, the Peshitta, two Syriac versions, and the Sahidic, but no patristic support. Now, this is showing the relationship amongst the Gospels. The interrelationships amongst the Synoptic Gospels also helps determine the original reading here. One of the secure results of scholarly study is the priority of Mark before Matthew and Luke. The example at hand is an instance of a doublet in which the same Markan statement is found in two places in Matthew. In the regular synoptic position, the Markan statement concerning offenses is utilized by Matthew 18:6-9 on the right. Matthew combines Mark's separate statements about the hand and foot into a single statement of Matthew 18:8, but Matthew still retains the Markan order of hand, foot, and then eye. In the doublet, the other passage still based on that passage in Mark, at Matthew 5:29-30, the statement of Mark 9:47 about the eye is brought ahead in order to immediately follow Jesus' teaching concerning the person who looks at a woman for the purpose of lusting after her. Then follows a statement from Mark 9:43 about the hand. Matthew at this point omits reference to the foot since it is unnecessary in this context. Now, it is significant that the verb in the earlier synoptic parallel at Mark 9:43 is the same as that found in the earliest Greek text of Matthew. Consequently, both internal considerations of what Matthew is most likely to have written based on these synoptic relationships, and external attestation of witnesses give support for the reading, go off into hell. Category number two, number four here. The earliest text lacks a contamination from the Lucan parallel. This was example number seven. At Matthew 5:44. Some of these get a little bit complex because there are so many manuscripts with different readings that they have to be categorized in different columns. At Matthew 5:44, the shorter reading, which is simply, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, over here on the left, and the readings are in column one that support that, is supported by Sinaiticus B, Family One manuscripts there, the oldest manuscript of the Old Latin, the Sinaitic Syriac and the Keratonian Syriac, in the Egyptian witnesses, the Sahidic and part of the Bohairic, and three patristic writers, Irenaeus, Origen, and Cyprian. This is a very strong and diversified array of witnesses supporting that reading. Now, before actually going through the listing of the many variant readings among the witnesses of this passage, it is necessary to compare the earliest form of Matthew 5:44 with the synoptic parallel at Luke 6. Could you adjust that a little bit? Over here is the passage from Luke 6:27-28. The two Matthean clauses are numbered 1 and 4, even though there were only two. They're numbered 1 and 4 there to correspond with the fact that we have 4 over here in Luke. The Lucan form has a double antithesis of four balanced imperatives instead of the twofold statement in the earliest form of Matthew. No witness of Luke has the shorter twofold statement of Matthew 5:44. That is, no Greek manuscript omits both the second and third Lucan clauses, and none has the Matthean second clause in substitution for the Lucan fourth clause. The major variants at Matthew 5:44 are the following. We've already looked at the first column, which has to do with the earliest form available in the manuscript witnesses. The later witnesses of Matthew 5:44 harmonize and or conflate this Matthean text with words or clauses from the Lucan parallel. The many variant readings of Matthew 5:44 are not simply gratuitous additions, but are actual conscious scribal efforts to fill out meaning by using wording from Luke. The variation of parts and word orders among witnesses of Matthew 5:44 mitigates against their originality. I'm not going to read through these for the interest of time, but each one of these supports, like the second column there, has the first statement and then simply 4a and 4c, so it follows the last part of Luke, and you can see kind of a relationship amongst these various witnesses. The fact that no manuscript of Matthew has the text in the exact order of Luke, that is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Look down here, they all are based on originally the Matthean form, and there's nothing that has 1, 2, 3, and 4 that hasn't really exactly copied Luke. Indicates that the text of Matthew with the twofold statement was not simply expanded in one operation to the Lucan form by inserting the second, third Lucan clauses and conflating the two forms of the final clause. The evidence indicates that it was, in fact, a series of partial harmonizations in which several forms arose. Very early, the second Matthean clause was substituted by the fourth Lutheran clause. Then either the third or the second Lutheran clause was added, and the last Matthean clause either not affected at all or conflated with Luke in different ways. However, the earliest extant texts in Greek, the earliest in Latin, the earliest in Syriac, the earliest in the Coptic, as well as the second century Irenaeus, provide a very strong support for the shorter form of Matthew 5:44. Okay, number five now. Category three is the earliest text preserves the original without a textual addition. We're going to look at the example 11, which is Matthew 6:13. The Matthean form of the Lord's Prayer is recorded in Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 to 13. And traditionally, the doxology, which are the words of praise to God, appear at the end of verse 13. This is the traditional form where it says, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever." That's where we normally hear it. The absence of any doxology at all, that is, the bare text with just the Lord's Prayer, no doxology at the end, is supported on the left there by Sinaiticus B.D.Z.017. All of those are unsealed manuscripts. Family 1 and several other cursive manuscripts. 7 Old Latin manuscripts. The original text of Jerome's Vulgate. The Syriac Acts of Thomas. The Bohairic, the Middle Egyptian, Tertullian, Origen, and Cyprian. This particular array of witnesses forms a very strong combination, since it includes representatives of the Proto-Alexandrian, that is Sinaiticus and B, the later Alexandrian, Z and the Bohairic, the so-called Pre-Caesarean, which is family 1, the Western text, D and the Old Latin, the Eastern text, supported by the Old Syriac and the Acts of Thomas, and the early patristic writers on the Lord's Prayer, Tertullian, Origen, and Cyprian. Also, it's interesting that several cursive manuscripts have following a note to Matthew 6:13, which says, the words for thine is the kingdom, up to the amen, do not lie in some manuscripts. So they were aware that all manuscripts didn't have it. Also, many manuscripts indicate uncertainty about the right of the doxology to stand at the end of the Lord's Prayer by printing it in red letters. The doxology seems to have originated as the Lord's Prayer was adapted to early Christian liturgical use, perhaps under the influence of 1 Chronicles 29 and 2 Timothy 4. The manuscript evidence shows a development of the text, and the diversity of readings in the added material argues against these additions being the original text. The smallest addition is at the end of the Matthean Lord's Prayer, the simple Amen, which is supported over there by one Greek manuscript, margin 1550 text of Josephus, and a number of late Vulgate manuscripts. Illustrative of the fact that the Lord's Prayer was easily susceptible to various later embellishments is the 4th century potsherd, and show this on number 6 now. Discovered in Greece about 90 years ago, it is inscribed with the Lord's Prayer without a doxology, followed by the final acclamation you see here, which is simply, "O Lord Christ," and the word for Christ is in the little monogram there, which was found in some of the very early manuscripts. Okay, back to 6 there. Rather than discuss all of these in detail, I think we'll summarize that the manuscripts show these various support throughout the textual tradition. "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory forever," found in this column, is supported by the most number of manuscripts, and is probably the official form in the Byzantine Church. However, there were some later additions, as you can see over in this one, where it said, "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost," or the Holy Spirit, Amen. So that there was a Trinitarian formula added at that part of the doxology. Number 7. There are several differences between the Matthean and Lucan versions of the Lord's Prayer. The earliest form of Luke, now we're looking at over on the far left there, is supported by P75 of the earliest 3rd century, simply has Father instead of Our Father which art in heaven. It lacks the phrase, thy will be done as in heaven, so in earth. It lacks the antithesis at the end, but deliver us from evil, and it also lacks the doxology. It is certainly significant that where these 4 points that Luke lacks material, the shorter form of Luke is completely contained in the longer form of Matthew. Various manuscripts of Luke have been harmonized to the fuller, more familiar form found in Matthew. In fact, this harmonization is so complete that in every single instance of these variants, there are some manuscripts of Luke that have those forms of Matthew except one, and that is the doxology. That single exception is the Matthean doxology. For the most exhausting Greek New Testament critical apparatus that has ever been published, it does not show any Greek manuscript, ancient version, or patristic writer that has assimilated Luke 11:4 to the doxology of Matthew 6:13. This is very strong evidence indeed that in the early Christian period, when such harmonizations between the Synoptic Gospels were made, the doxology of Matthew 6:13 had not yet been added to any of the texts of Matthew. Conversely, it cannot be reasonably argued that the traditional doxology is original to Matthew 6:13 and that it was deleted from some Matthean text to confirm to the absence of any doxology in Luke. There are no manuscripts that have a doxology in Luke. And I don't think it's right to argue that way, because in the Lord's Prayer there is no manuscript of Matthew which ever omits words to agree with the Lucan paradigm. The process is clearly in the direction of fuller, more complete doxological forms. Okay, turn on. Now, the Sermon on the Mount in the Book of Mormon, that's probably why most of you are here, to see what the comparison. Now that 11 places in the New Testament version of the Sermon on the Mount have been examined, we've actually looked at only three this morning, attention can be shifted to the version in the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon proclaims that in AD 34, the resurrected Jesus Christ descended from heaven to a place somewhere in the New World called Bountiful, and there delivered a sermon recorded at 3 Nephi chapters 12 to 14, which is explicitly patterned after the Matthean Sermon on the Mount. Following a few other instructions, Jesus told the people to write these sayings down after he left them. Evidently, they carried out this instruction to make a written record of what Jesus taught them, because the next day, the Nephi 12 disciples were able to preach to the people the same words which Jesus had spoken, nothing varying from the words which Jesus had spoken. Later the second day, the Book of Mormon people were again told to write down what Jesus told them. Consequently, if the Nephites did as the Lord told them, this sermon of Jesus was recorded in large plates of Nephi on the very day it was delivered. Mormon, the 4th century prophet historian, utilized these same plates to transcribe a copy of the Sermon on the Mount onto the plates of Mormon. Joseph Smith affirms that he translated the Reformed Egyptian text on these plates into the English language. Joseph Smith dictated the Book of Mormon account of the sermon to his scribe Oliver Cowdery during May of 1829, and the first edition was published in March of 1830, the first printed Book of Mormon. Assuming that Matthew chapters 5 to 7 and 3 Nephi chapters 12 to 14 both record a single discourse delivered by Jesus to his followers, there are two completely separate lines of transmission of this discourse. One recorded and preserved in the many manuscripts in the Old World that we've been looking at, and the other recorded and preserved on metal plates in the New. Naturally, there would be differences due to the different audiences, but surely it would be instructive to compare the two accounts in some detail. The text of this Book of Mormon sermon provides an ideal opportunity to ascertain its accuracy as a real translation. For Hugh Nibley has suggested that one must test the Book of Mormon against its purported background in antiquity. If at each of these 11 points the Book of Mormon has a variant version differing from both forms of the extant Greek, from both the earliest ascertainable Greek text and the later derivative Greek text, then one would be unable to pronounce judgment on the Book of Mormon version. This is so because the differing text in the Book of Mormon could very likely be the way the sermon was delivered in the New World. If the Book of Mormon text supports the better and demonstrably more ancient manuscripts, which have become available in the last 470 years, it would be striking confirmation of the Book of Mormon's historicity. However, if the Book of Mormon text always sides with the secondary Greek text, which is demonstrably a later development in the Greek, then this dependence would be strong evidence against the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Actually, it oversimplifies the problem to say the secondary Greek text, because in 5 of these 11 examples, it is not simply a choice between two competing readings, but between several possible variant readings. I won't list them all, but it turns out that it is theoretically possible for the Book of Mormon to have its own text up to 11 times, it could be different in each one of these, or to coincide with any of 45 known variants and subvariants among the passages, a total of 56 possible readings. If the Book of Mormon departs from the King James Version to agree with the original text, it would indeed be independent verification of the Book of Mormon as a genuine document from antiquity. Now, one can examine the Book of Mormon at the points in the Sermon on the Mount where the evidence is overwhelmingly against the Textus Receptus and in favor of the modern critical Greek text. That is, these 11 examples that we've been looking at. It is this writer's conclusion, arrived at after diligent study of the documents that have been utilized in the analysis of the selected examples, that the historicity of the Book of Mormon has not been verified by modern manuscript discovery. The Book of Mormon text does not agree with the earliest Greek text at these 11 points, but in each case agrees with the Textus Receptus and the King James Version. Not only do the distinctive Book of Mormon additions and revisions to the King James Version never receive ancient support, but also the important Book of Mormon omissions do not receive such support. There's one example, one exception to that, a small omission of the phrase without a cause, but they had to be eliminated from discussion because the attestation is ambiguous. There is some evidence to suppose that it was there and some evidence to suppose it was not there. Some of the editors of the Greek New Testament printed in the text in brackets. It's not supported by some of the early versions, and also it was well known in both Greek studies and American and English commentaries and so forth. So we haven't been able to use that one. The same omission, by the way, in two texts is not nearly as significant in terms of establishing the connection between them as having the same distinctive addition or the same alternate reading, because things could be left out accidentally and there could be a correspondence that's simply a coincidence. It is significant to note that among the 45 known variants and subvariants of these secure Book of Mormon secure examples from the New Testament, the Book of Mormon always aligns itself with the particular derivative text found in the Textus Receptus printed by Stephanus in 1550, and never agrees with either the original text or any of the other known variants. How can this startling agreement of the Book of Mormon with the Greek of the 16th century Textus Receptus be explained? The solution to the problem seems to be that there is in fact no direct dependence on the Greek Textus Receptus, but rather on the English text of the King James Version, whose translators use the Textus Receptus. Is there some way to establish indisputably that the Book of Mormon indeed has such a direct connection with the King James Version, and that the Book of Mormon is not an independent translation, at least for the Sermon on the Mount? That's all we're talking about. If one were to examine textual variants among the printed editions of the Book of Mormon, all this would show is revealed changes from 1830 to the present. In the absence of the gold plates, the only recourse is to examine the two manuscripts written in 1829. For the 1830 edition is useless in this regard because all it shows is the transmission of the text from the original manuscript to the printed text. The earliest attainable text of the Book of Mormon is contained in the original manuscript, which was written at the moment the words of its text were dictated by Joseph Smith. Examining its pages gives one the unequaled opportunity to view the unfolding text of the Book of Mormon. The text of the Sermon on the Mount has not survived, unfortunately, in the original manuscript, but there are four pages in the extant portions of that manuscript that do contain long biblical quotations. Scrutiny of these pages discloses a very revealing textual correction in the original manuscript. I've been talking about Matthew too much. At 1 Nephi chapter 20, verse 11, the words of Isaiah 48, "How should my name be polluted?" are revised in the original reading of the original manuscript, that is the first hand reading, to how should I suffer my name to be polluted? Then the King James words, "how should," and the Book of Mormon, "I," are crossed out, followed by a revision giving the final, the revision that we know in the Book of Mormon text, "I will not suffer my name to be polluted." This discloses unmistakably that for a biblical quotation within the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith used the English King James Version as a base text for the revision embodied in the Book of Mormon. In fact, there are even biblical quotations in the Book of Mormon where the incongruously foreshortened Book of Mormon text can best be explained as being due to Joseph Smith accidentally skipping over some words while reading it aloud from the King James Version during the dictation process. All of these considerations force us to place the origin of the Book of Mormon account of the Sermon on the Mount on a historical timeline somewhere after 1769, and that's based on the italics in the King James that were not in the first 1611 edition, and before 1830 when the Book of Mormon was published, this analysis based on textual criticism, which is what we've been doing, independently confirms Christer Stendahl's discussion from the perspective of redaction criticism and genre criticism that the Book of Mormon text of the Sermon on the Mount is not a genuine translation from an ancient language, but rather Joseph Smith's 19th century Targumic expansion of the English King James Version text. Among other things, Stendahl discusses the implication of the Book of Mormon extension of a miracle from a single person to a whole multitude, the Targumizing expansion at 3 Nephi 12, and the Rationalizing expansion at 3 Nephi 11 26. Stendahl indicates that apocryphal documents have such clarifying expansions and rational explanations, and concludes that it seems very clear that the Book of Mormon belongs to and shows many of the typical signs of the Targums and the pseudepigraphic recasting of biblical material. In terms of pinpointing the origin of the Book of Mormon, even more significant than the Book of Mormon revisions are the places where the Book of Mormon blindly follows the King James Version at the precise point where the King James Version falls into error due to mistranslating the Greek or translating late and derivative Greek texts, which are demonstrably secondary developments in the textual tradition amongst the manuscripts that are available and in various European libraries. The evidence leads one inexorably to the conclusion, at least for the section comprising the Sermon on the Mount, 3 Nephi 12 and 14, that the term translation seems inappropriate, since nowhere in the Book of Mormon version of Jesus' masterful sermon is there any indisputable evidence of being a translation from an ancient document. At these 11 points, the earlier and better texts of the Gospel of Matthew take us back to the earliest form of the Sermon on the Mount, but the Book of Mormon never takes us to a verifiable text of antiquity. Thank you.
I think we all have been impressed by this introduction into the world of Greek textual criticism in the field of New Testament studies. As Dr. Larson has pointed out, it's an area of a great deal of information, a lot of texts, and it's been interesting taking one example as the Sermon on the Mount to see what kind of efforts the scholars make and have made and are making in order to try and get back as close as possible to the time of Jesus and the sermon that he actually gave to us. There are two or three comments that I'd like to make in response to the paper, and then I assume that we'll have some time for your questions. The first concern I have is an assumption that seems to be made tacitly that we need to look at a little bit more closely to see if the basis of this argument is completely consistent, and that's it seems to be an assumption that if we were to be able to reconstruct the Greek text accurately, that we would then have the words of Jesus as he delivered them to the people in the New Testament, in the Old World, so that they could then be compared to the tradition of the words as they were presented in the Nephite world. And that seems to be the assumption that Jesus spoke Greek, which is not the case. There is some debate about what language Jesus did speak when he was on the earth, whether it was Aramaic, which is usually what is said, or a vernacular form of Hebrew that was used in the Palestinian world. One study by a scholar named Emerton in the Journal of Theological Studies in 1973 concluded that Hebrew was used as a vernacular in Judea in the time of Jesus, but that Aramaic was also used there, but was in more general use in Galilee. So the assumption would be that if Jesus was talking to people in Galilee, he would have spoken in Aramaic. But in Judea, he would have spoken in Hebrew. And this is preserved, or this evidence for this, for his language, is derived from the New Testament, and words that are preserved in the Greek text, either names or some few phrases, for example, the last words of Jesus on the cross, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, are preserved in the Greek text as words that he would have spoken in his language. So it seems to me that we have a theoretical problem with the construct of this argument, that at no time can we get back to a writing of the actual words that Jesus spoke in the old world. We're always dealing with a translation from the words of Jesus into Greek. And whereas in the New Testament, in the New World, in the Nephite world, Jesus spoke to the people, and that there is also a problem, and we're assuming that he has spoken Nephite, the language that the people were speaking, although he was a resurrected being, and there could have been no language exchanged at all, for all we know. It's, when you start listening to resurrected beings talking, you don't always know what if they're talking to you, or all the experiences I've had with them, I never really understood that process. But so the problem that we have is if we have the theoretical comparison of the two texts, we have a Greek translation in the old world and a Nephite transcription in the new world that we are trying to compare. At least that's the theory behind this comparison. However, as Dr. Larson points out, all of this really is beside the point, because it is quite clear that Joseph Smith, in most of the texts that he used in the Book of Mormon, is quoting directly from the King James Version. There's never been any question about that. We cannot avoid agreeing with the observation by Christopher Stendhal that the Book of Mormon text of the Sermon on the Mount is not a genuine translation in this sense. Joseph Smith doesn't seem to be dealing with an original text in much of the stuff that he includes in the Book of Mormon that is parallel in the King James. Now I want to add a little bit more about what by translation, because we talk about a genuine translation, and there's some concern about how what a translation is in the sense of the way Joseph Smith used it. The dependence of the Book of Mormon on the King James Version is certainly not original with Stendhal. Sidney Sperry pointed out over 20 years ago in his book called The Problems of the Book of Mormon, he said that Joseph Smith used the King James Version when he came to familiar passage on the gold plates, as we shall not deny. In this respect, he did only what many translators would have done. Certainly the Book of Mormon uses the language of the King James Version. Not only do we have word-for-word copying, but there are multitudes of examples of phrases and words which are used in the translation which come from the King James. Partly, this can be explained as the ploy of a translator who finds a passage similar to the one that he is translating already, translated in a well-known published work, and then copies it into his own translation in order to speed up the process of translation and to make his work more familiar to the audience for which it is intended. I think that's important in Joseph Smith's day. The King James was certainly the Bible that was used in his community, and I think we probably don't realize how pervasive that Bible would have been, or the language of that Bible. We can assume that the language of Joseph Smith's day was saturated with the language of the King James Version, particularly if he was trying to write in a religious language, which was what he would be doing in the Book of Mormon. So it is obvious that Joseph Smith copied from the King James Version. The motivation behind it, we can speculate. One example and one that is that Sperry talks about, and it's quite obvious that a translator, if he's translating something and he finds a passage in a published work that's parallel to what he's translating, he'll copy the outside of his published work because it makes the translation process easier and faster. The next comment is, what is a translation to translation? If we come to the conclusion that the passages quoted in the Book of Mormon from the King James are not really a translation of an original text, then we say, well, if Joseph Smith claims that it's a translation and it isn't the translation as we would call it, what is it? Yet Joseph Smith was never very strict in the use of this term translation. For example, in the Book of Abraham, which we view as a translation, in this on the page facing facsimile 2 in the Book of Abraham, the page is entitled "An Explanation of the Foregoing Cut." So, what the words that follow are an explanation of facsimile 2. At the bottom of the page, we read, "The above translation is given as far as we have any right to give at the present time." So the explanation at the top equates to translation at the bottom. And when if you compare the explanation of the page that's given to the facsimile, the sections of the facsimile that contain diagrams or pictures are explained, those that contain hieroglyphs, nothing are done with them. So it is not a translation in the sense that we would use it. Therefore, explanation equates to translation. And we receive similar terminology in reference to Joseph Smith's work with the Bible itself. What used to be called the Inspired Revision now is called the Joseph Smith Translation. The process here the general consensus is that on the Joseph Smith Translation, the text that is received there that is different than the King James never claimed to have been derived from some original text. It is added from inspiration, revelation, or from whatever source that a prophet would receive the words that he writes down. No one has claimed that he was translating the Bible, so here that he was receiving revelation. I think that the issue here is when we say that the Book of Mormon is a true translation, and we cannot show that it is a translation in the sense that we would do it, then you have to ask, for a prophet, what does he mean when he says that a document is a true document, that it is a perfect document, that it is a correct translation? We cannot show that he means it in the sense that we would use it as a translator or as a scholar or as someone that is concerned with the accuracy of words and the way they're translated. I think that that the way that a prophet uses the word true and truth is important in this context. He usually is not that concerned with accuracy in transmission of words. What he is concerned with is, well, the message that these words provide to us bring the reader closer to God, closer to conversion, closer to the Spirit. Will it bring it past this person's eternal life and immortality? If it will do that, then it's true, then it's correct, then it's perfect. And if it's got grammatical errors, if it has transpositions, if it makes mistakes historically as far as being a historical document in our sense, that's all irrelevant. If it will bring to pass the eternal life of man, then it's a perfect translation. If it deals with bringing a concept from the ancient world to the modern world, then it's a translation. And I think that that was a feeling that was present within those that were copying Jesus' words in the old world. We wouldn't have all of the additions and deletions, mainly additions to the Greek New Testament text, if people didn't feel that they were at liberty to add something if they felt that it would convey the message better. So they were not always concerned with accurate transmittal of the text. They felt perfectly comfortable with adding the doxology if they felt that that would inspire the listeners to respond more to the message. They're not that concerned with the accuracy. So I think that when we want to judge the translation of the Book of Mormon, that it needs to be judged in the context of how a prophet would have used it. And within that context, as Christopher Stendhal in his speech on the Book of Mormon has pointed out, the message the Book of Mormon gives is one that would be valuable to the faithful. And the issue of the scholarship or scholastic accuracy is one that is irrelevant to the motivations of the prophets and to the ears of the faithful.
I'd like to thank both of you. I think that we've heard not only some differing information, but two different perspectives. We have about 10 minutes for questions, if these gentlemen are willing to answer them.
Question for Eric Olson. In talking about how you don't believe Joseph Smith is really that concerned with accuracy in the words, you sort of provided your own definition of a prophet, and I guess I've heard a lot of different definitions during the conference until now. How do you account for the fact that Joseph revised many times several of his own revelations during his lifetime, specifically altered words, inserted new words, deleted other words, to convey new concepts? It seems to me he was really concerned with accuracy of his
message. Well, I think that gets back to the issue of how do we receive words or receive ideas. If you have a basis that you receive information from God through revelation, and this is in parallel to how Jesus gave his words to the Nephite world when he was a resurrected being, how do they receive that information? How does it get into their mind? I mean, do they hear a word spoken and it goes in their ear and does it go through sound waves? Or is the concept transmitted directly to the part of the brain that processes concepts? So, that's a theoretical problem. But I think in Joseph Smith's instance, that if he received information and then he was faced with the problem, and this is the problem that prophets have, is how do I get this information that I have to the people here in concepts that they will understand? And that's the reason prophets tend to use a lot of, in the biblical times and in modern times, they use a lot of stories and analogies and metaphors and comparisons and anything that they can try to get across to the people the concepts in their mind. And I think that we see in Joseph Smith's case an evolution sometimes in his ability to express himself. So that he was a self-taught person. He was not a scholar. He was not trained. He rarely even did write much in the early days. Later in his life, he got a little bit more proficient. So he would be forced, like if you take section 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants, if you look in the Book of Commandments, and all missionaries usually have to memorize this, and it's more easy to memorize in the Book of Commandments because it doesn't have as many of the attributes that a missionary is supposed to have. But in the Doctrine and Covenants, he's added about 10 more, and it makes it a little harder to memorize. But I think that what happens is that he goes back and he looks at something that he had said 10 years ago and said, well, I remember what I was trying to say, and I've learned some more words since then, and so I'll just add them. I'm conveying the same concept, the same thought, the same... I'm making it clearer, making it more clarified. We're dealing with how does he convey the concept that he has into words that his audience will understand. And if he later finds words that he thinks they'll understand it better, then... See, the concept that we have nowadays of trying to establish a written text that will not be changed, that is 100% accurate, it goes back to the Protestant Reformation when people felt that they had to have a written text upon which to base their belief in God. And that if you had the written text had to be guarded and preserved and protected because that was the source of information on God, was the written text. You didn't have prophets, you had a written text. And that is a Protestant notion that doesn't pertain within the Mormon context. The primacy is not the written word in Mormon, in at least my understanding of Mormon philosophy. The primacy is not the written word. The primacy is the spoken word. And the embodiment of the spoken word into the written word, the written word can change. And there's nothing inviolate about the written word in the Mormon context.
I'd like to just add a couple of comments. For one thing, I haven't had experiences with resurrected beings. I don't know if there is an emanation to my soul for a message. But all I know is that the Book of Mormon text says that Jesus spoke these words and they wrote them down. Now I've been quite technical in looking at the New Testament evidence. Let's just sit back and think what we have here. I agree with Eric's point that, in fact, we haven't talked about the original words of Jesus, the Aramaic that he spoke when he was traveling around and talking to people. We're looking at the Greek text which is all that is extant, and translations of that into the versions. But what do we have? We can establish that, in fact, we don't know what he said, but all we can say is what is the best available evidence as of now of what was in the original Matthew, the Greek Matthew. Okay? But what we can do in looking at that, we can identify certain things. I've examined 11 of them where I'm very confident that those 11 places, we have the original text of Matthew, but we also have the variant text that was established in the 3rd century, the 5th century, the 7th century, whatever, late secondary texts. So we come over to the Book of Mormon, and here we have a marvelous opportunity with records that were evidently according to the text as we read it. I mean, we have to read it in English. That's the only text we have of the Book of Mormon to date, of original quality. It says that we have the text, and they're on plates, and Mormon had plates in the 4th century, and Joseph Smith had those plates with him. Here was an opportunity to make, I mean, we were always told up until the most recent years that he made a translation. Now, we can discuss what translation means, but just think what that's saying. Here were a chance that these were recorded on there. Well, maybe he took the easy way out and just went to the King James Version and just copied it. Well, people that do that get F's on their term papers or other things. But what we have in the Book of Mormon is, yes, I see evidence of the King James Version being used, and it's nothing new. Many people now, it wasn't always that way. People in the earlier days of the church said that, in fact, he did a real translation. He didn't use the King James. He made a separate translation. It just happened to support the great King James Version. But the point is that I think that I'm able to show is that here we have 11 mistakes that were never known in the King James. Nothing against them. They didn't have the manuscripts that we now have to be able to know that. If they did have them, they would have corrected. They were good scholars. But with these 11 mistakes, we have an opportunity to look at the Book of Mormon, and all I said at the end is that we have no support. There's a lack of evidence to support its historicity. I would have thought that maybe we could have one or two or three or something to indicate in a real way, not just because you believe it's true, but in a real way to show, yes, this is an ancient text that's been translated. I find that we don't see evidence of that in 3rd Nephi 12, 13, and 14. Okay, other questions?
Most speakers seem to agree that Joseph Smith likely used the King James Version, maybe just copied from it in writing at least parts of the Book of Mormon. I'd like to ask Dr. Larson, is there any evidence that Joseph Smith just didn't simply do that, simply used the King James Bible and other materials, at least in this discussion, without any reference to plates or other records?
Well, yes, there is. See, we're going through kind of a change in the attitude of how we approach the Book of Mormon. In the early days, it was talked about as a real translation by the gift and power of God. And now we're finding that more and more is being done about looking in a hat in the darkness and the plates being over the corner covered up. And people are saying that he didn't even use the plates. And the King James Version, yes, I think was definitely used. And one thing we need to remember, too, is that I've said on these 11 examples, here were places where the King James is wrong, and I find that, unfortunately, the Book of Mormon follows that and shows no evidence of what those ancient readings were, like the doxology at the end of the Lord's Prayer. There's no evidence that could have easily been deleted. I mean, we quoted Sidney B. Sperry, and one of the things that he said is that, yes, he did use the King James Version. As long as the sermon in the familiar rendering of Matthew 5-7 agreed substantially with the Nephite version, the prophet used it word for word. He was copying the Bible. Otherwise, he corrected it to conform with the text before him on the metal plates. Now, that's what I don't find any evidence of. I don't find any evidence of that. In fact, the King James Version is not simply copied in the Book of Mormon. It is revised. There are a number of additions, expansions, changes in text, and a few omissions. But with all of those, not simply a carbon copy of the Bible, but in all those places, we've only looked at 11 places where we can identify mistakes that the King James Version has, but in all the hundreds of places that we have in the Book of Mormon different from the King James, and you compare all the thousands, literally, of manuscripts and available sources, we don't find the support that we would expect.
I suspect we are left with some interesting hallway debates. It's time to close. I'm sorry. Thank you for coming and for your participation, and thanks to Dr. Martin.